Get ready for a week-long celebration of music, community, and fabulous fun with Joy Radiothon 2024. Joy has the largest collection of rainbow podcast content in the world, and you can help keep us out loud and proud by donating during Joy Radiothon 2024. Just go to joy.org.au/radiothon. Mark it in your calendars because Joy Radiothon returns June 1st to 7th. And remember, we all flourish with joy.
Hey, this is Ads from the Hump Day Crew. Thank you so much for listening to another one of our podcasts. And thank you for supporting the Hump Day Crew and Joy 94.9.
Thank you very much for your time today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Now, one thing we wanted to ask you about, from all your other work is quite comic work. What made you go for the role in Queer as Folk?
Well, I've been doing, most of the play work I had done in Chicago before I moved to Los Angeles was fairly serious. I was in Equus and True West and plays like that. So I always had that as, a go-to. But the truth is, it's more about Hollywood than it's about me. If you get pegged as a comic, you're not going to get asked to come in and do drama, and vice versa. So it was more a question of opportunity at a certain point. The truth is, more people had turned down Queer as Folk than would go in on it. Otherwise, I wouldn't have gotten it because I wasn't available when they first started casting it. And then the fact that I was even able to audition for it was kind of more reflective on the fact that people were just afraid to do it.
I heard, Hal, that there were about 30 people initially listed to audition for Queer as Folk, but Andy and the producers only got 3 people turning up. And did you have apprehensions going into this role, having fear that you'd be typecast to some extent?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's certainly lighter now. Obviously, a couple of years on from Queer as Folk, we definitely have a much more open look at this thing. Right now in the States, we have 5 states that have just legalized gay marriage. So it's a different climate now, certainly. But when I did it, this was pre-even Queer Eye for the Straight Guy being on the air. And I couldn't even go on certain talk shows because they didn't want the word queer on the chyron underneath me. So that should give you some indication of what people were up against just thinking about auditioning for the show.
Wow. That's interesting, too, because without Queer as Folk, there wouldn't be Queer Eye for the Straight Guy or even the L Word.
And credit where credit is due. Obviously, Britain was ahead of us on that because our show is based on theirs. The nice thing about, Showtime was that they committed to do it for a very long time. They gave us a 5-year contract to start right away, and so that was pretty bold on their part, and sticking with it. But yeah, everywhere else, though, running scared. Everybody was just, this is pre, people forget this is pre-Brokeback, this is pre any of that stuff. And especially on television, to have that level of sexuality, even if it was heterosexual, was a lot, much less having it be gay. So this, it was pivotal. And it's nice to know that to some degree it's paid off here in the States.
And it's still
a long way to go, but it's definitely shifted things.
And it's still very much today, after 5 years on, after it finishing, you're still getting comments and still speaking about it. It's still very much in everyone's mind.
I think it speaks to the fact that it's historical. It was a historic show. So to be a part of it, I don't think I'll ever stop answering questions about it my whole career, truth be told. The only change I wish I had really was that we speak in terms of it. Isn't it amazing that you even needed to do a show like Queer as Folk? That's the question that I'm looking forward to having to answer one day.
Hal, what kind of preparation did you do getting ready for the role?
I treated it like, honest to God, like I treat every role I do. I to some degree, I create a couple of physicalizations for the character. If I'm doing someone, if their voice is different, I'll modify mine to sort of reflect where they are emotionally. But other than that, it really wasn't that different. Obviously, if I were to go to a gay club and hang out, I would not have the same personal reactions that Michael would internally, and that's really where you have to get to the character. If I went to a gay club, I'd be a straight guy at a gay club going, all right, this is fine, nice music, whatever. But by going to, let's say, a straight club and kind of hearkening back to when I was a teenager or somebody, going to a club and wishing somebody would notice me, wishing a girl would notice me, wishing that anybody gave a crap that I was there, that's more reflective of how Michael feels when he's in a club. And if you can get in contact with that, then you can bridge the gap between the character and yourself.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about Michael, obviously, and we've all got our favorite storylines. What was some of your favorite storylines throughout the five series?
It was great for me when Hunter came along, with Michael as a mother, basically, as a parent. And really dealing with that, because it was really that and Ben's illness, which were two big shifting storylines for Michael, were the point in the story where in the arc he starts to grow up. You know, a lot of people have issues with who Michael is and how he acts in the beginning of the series, but when you're creating a growth for somebody emotionally, they've got to start someplace you don't like, so they end up someplace you do. And Michael, you know, that moment where he looks in Ben's medicine cabinet and can't go through with having sex with him was an amazing, you know, moment to play as an actor. And it was also very difficult for a lot of the audience watching, because not knowing what the next episode was, which was that, yes, he feels this fear, but he believes in Ben and loves him enough to get over it. There was a lot of negative reaction to that first that episode. So that was an interesting ride as a performer to go through, with the audience not knowing what was happening. It was not like seeing a movie, knew what happened in the end. It was out over a few weeks. Same thing with the Hunter storyline, not liking him at first, and the sort of an inside trick, but that trick I used towards the Hunter character as Michael. Michael treated him like a school in the house. When he first shows up, if you watch how Michael is reacting to him, somebody with a squirrel that snuck into their house, or a rat or a bat, something, is this almost bumpy skittishness about him, trying not to be afraid and maintain your own dignity. And it worked out. So those were really, there was a lot of deep feeling portrayed in the arcs of those, those relationships between Michael and Ben, Michael and Hunter, that I really appreciated and loved.
One of the good things Queer as Folk did that I think it really excelled at is portraying real storylines, like arguments that you'd seen between two people, or relationships between the core characters or the nucleus characters that were very real and portrayed really accurately. Was it great to be a part of that?
Absolutely. And I think the reason we were able to do that was because it was two men and two women in a relationship. The truth is, in modern film and television, there's still the sexual mores that are of the general populace attached to male-female relationships. So automatically, you're going to get someone is superior, someone is inferior in the relationship, because in whatever movie or film, it's usually the male is portrayed stronger, the woman weaker, or vice versa, depending on the reversal of it. Whereas in gay relationships, there's none of that backstory that people are used to. So there's a terrific part, opening for a balance in the portrayal of both sides of an issue or an argument or an emotion.
With the Ben story and the AIDS story, one interesting aspect that I thought that the Queer as Folk explored was the fact that when Michael actually wanted to get AIDS because he felt he was missing out on something, what was the reaction to that storyline?
That was tough. I mean, it was ultimately that storyline was about calling Ben on his isolation, less about Michael actually wanting to have it. Obviously, when you're dealing with that storyline, to some degree, all bets are off. Everyone is dealing with some very heavy stuff. So almost any emotional reaction is going to be an honest one. Yeah, so there was, when Michael was going to stick himself with the needle at one point, that was a tough one, because I had to actually decide whether or not Michael would have gone through with it. And I had to go into that scene believing that somehow he might. Like, he had to be convinced and committed, because he loved Ben so much, that he might go through with it. And that meant he had to some degree come to terms with committing suicide himself for the person he loves, which is a very, very strong reaction. That's definitely the heavy lifting of the acting world, you know? All of that had, it was ripe with, everyone had some sort of issue or attitude towards that storyline, because it's so loaded.
Now, talking about people that Michael loved, of course he loved his mother, and Debbie was the kind of mother you'd love to have as a gay mother, as long as she wasn't your mother.
Right. Yeah, interestingly enough, and Sharon Gless and I have a wonderful working relationship and the like, I actually think the relationship between Michael and Debbie was profoundly dysfunctional. And largely unhealthy. And to some degree, it had to have been, otherwise Michael, with such a supportive mother, why was he still in the closet at 30, which is when we start the series? when you're standing in that situation, you're looking at the relationship on its merits, you have to look at it for what it really is as the actor and go, wow, he's got all these great friends. He's his best friend is probably the gayest man in the world. And his mother could not be more supportive. His uncle is gay. He's seen him through surviving AIDS to some degree, for a time anyways. And yet he's still not comfortable coming out in his environment. What is that about? And it has to be with that tug and pull between having his own boundaries with his mother, which he felt like he had none. You know, Debbie told Michael he was gay when he was young. He didn't say it out loud first. So it's a really interesting, you know, that's a huge boundary issue between mother and son.
One of the interesting things about Deb and Michael's relationship, and you were talking about the dysfunctionality of it, the fact is when Michael was in search of who his real father was, Michael found out it was actually a drag queen, and Debbie was adamant, right. No, it was someone who won a Purple Star, etc., etc., and Michael's like, yes, that's who he was. He kind of just gave in.
Right. I mean, I think that says a lot there, that again, she's so supportive of him as a gay man and coming out, but at the same time she's not comfortable with telling him who his real father was, on some element that the fact that he was a drag queen might be a bit of an issue. It's that, you know, that was always, you know, that conflict, which I think made the story so ripe and explained why Michael was where he was at the time and why he was in such desperate need of growing up on his own terms.
I was watching another clip and you were talking about your favorite moments of Queer as Folk, and you said your ultimate favorite was when Michael gets hit by Debbie.
Yeah, well, those moments, I think, made the relationship between mother and son real. When we did the very first time she ever hit me was when we were walking back from Justin's house and we're talking about her coat. And she says, you'll buy me an... I go, you're still wearing that old coat? And she goes, you'll buy me a new one when you're all rich and famous. And Michael says, well, like that'll ever happen. And she slaps him for saying that, for denying his own potential. And so when Debbie, was supposed to do this, she's supposed to do it with the fierceness of an Italian mother. Well, Sharon Gless detests physical violence. She, interestingly enough, was in the she performed in the West End in London in the play Misery, and they had to cut one of the fight scenes because it was too much for her. She didn't like it. She couldn't bring herself to do it. And so I actually had to take her hand and hit myself in the back of the head really hard with it to show her that I could take it. I mean, I've trained in martial arts since I was 8 years old. I taught for 7 years. I'm fairly certain I can take a slap once and again. And so I really wanted that moment when she hits me, if she pulled that smack at all, then the audience would be sitting there going, these are actors. But if she really wobbles me upside the head, all of a sudden, wow, only a mother would hit her son like that. And that's the way it really, it did play out. That moment sort of cemented our closeness. And from that point on, she'd smack me so hard it'd make your fillings rattle.
I'm getting a little bit concerned. The cast is sounding rather armed and dangerous, because we spoke to Peter Page a couple of weeks ago and he was bragging about how good he is at both armed and unarmed combat from when he was studying in college as well. So you have a rather vicious cast.
Well, you know, quite frankly, in this country, if you're going to do a show like Queer as Folk, or if you're going to be the type of person who would do it, you better be prepared to take care of yourself, because there's a lot of people out there who don't want you to do it, and they have no qualms about showing you how much they might dislike your work. So it's the smart way to go. There was a period in this country where, as a gay person, that was the safest thing you could do anywhere you were. Now it's isolated to bad pockets in the country. Certainly, there are safe places to be, which is lovely. But if you're gonna be the kind of person who takes on a project like Queer as Folk, it doesn't hurt to know how to dish it out as well as take it, as it were.
I believe you've been in a couple of other movies, Spider-Man 2 being one. Did you have to use your martial arts skills in that movie?
Nope, just a comedian. it's funny that I've yet to use those in stuff that I've done. Although we're working on that this fall, I'm doing a new feature that I'll get to kind of show off a little, which will be fun. But I've been touring as a stand-up for the last year and a half. That's what I started doing. That's what I do the most.
Yep.
as a comedian. And I may even be coming down to Australia to do some shows, which is I'm really excited about.
Oh, so brilliant. We can keep an eye
on that out now.
Are you coming to the Melbourne International Comedy Festival?
Yes. You know what? I was invited to that while I was at the Montreal Comedy Festival last year. So I'm hoping we get to work that out. Yeah,
fantastic. Because we're actually based in Melbourne, so you should come in and do a bit of stand-up for us as well.
I would be more than happy to. So we'll you know, if were I to be there, I'll definitely make it happen.
Either that or we'll let you sit down while you're in the studio. You don't have to stand up. We've got chairs in Australia.
I appreciate that. But they spin the other direction or something. I know that.
What other things have you got coming up in the future then?
I have a new series on VH1 that I created myself and sold called Unreal, which makes fun of the reality world, that, you know, of reality television. So it's basically a behind the scenes kind of extras about reality shows, as it were. It's good fun. I'm very happy with it, and it'll start in the fall. So we're actually working on that right now. We're currently casting it. So
and you still got the long hair?
It's my first show I've ever sold. So
that must be very exciting.
Yeah, it is. You almost feel like you've graduated as a performer.
So is that something you'd like to pursue more?
Well, my whole life I've done a lot of sketch comedy, and I've directed and shot like somewhere in the odds of like 35 short films. So I come from a kind of a bootstrapper background in that, I moved to Los Angeles when I was 16, when I was 18 years old, 16 days after I graduated high school. I packed all my crap in my car and I moved to L.A. and to be an actor. And I didn't know anyone. I didn't have any, friends. I didn't have any family in the industry. I didn't even really know where I was going to stay. And so I learned a lot about making your own way and and deciding for yourself specifically. If nobody's going to help you, you got to help yourself. So I just started doing it myself. So once the idea of selling a show and producing shows and directing shows eventually seems a very logical step. Although I have no interest in stopping performing, though. Like, as an actor, I would never pass up really being able to act in something wonderful. And as a stand-up, that's something I'm committed to as an artist for my entire life. That's a self-defining art for me, more than, being a writer or a director or a producer would be.
And talking about your future, what's the future of your hair?
It's short right now. I just cut it for the cancer charity Locks of Love last 3 weeks ago. Yeah.
Because a lot of the recent footage of you, you've got long hair nearly down to your shoulders.
Yeah, well, it was all the way down to my shoulders in the newest stuff. But yeah, absolutely. I'm Native American, so I grew up with long hair. I have long hair naturally when I'm just being myself. So when I'm not doing a role specifically that requires short hair, I keep it long. That's how I live. I've been doing a cartoon and touring as a stand-up for the last 2 years, so nobody cared what I looked like, per se. It certainly wouldn't interfere with a character. So I just kept it long, as it would,
It kind of ties into your image for 01, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It certainly fits better. I've always, I have a faux hawk right now, essentially. And I've always felt that, it's always weird when you go see a rock band and the guys on stage look like you're staring at them going, oh man, I forgot to return a video at Blockbuster. Oh, that looks like the guy who works at the drugstore. That's not really rock and roll to me. You got to kick it up a notch a little bit. So when my hair's short, I have to, paint my nails black and wear a lot of eyeliner to get the point across. But I think people understand.
And I believe everyone gets a bit of an opinion when you've got long hair as well.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Kids. The funny thing is everybody becomes your mom, oh, goodness. Why are you growing your hair out? I'm on Twitter, and I actually got a Twitter the other day after I'd cut my hair. I have a little, goatee that I wear occasionally, and this dude just feels like he has the right to just go, shave your whiskers. That's all he said. That's his Twitter. Shave your whiskers. And I'm like, it's kind of amazing that we live in a world where you could just say that to someone, just order them to do something, even though you don't know them, you've never met them, you have no experience with them personally. It's kind of amazing. Anyways, he had dyed blonde hair, so I Twittered him back, you know, go back to your natural color and then we'll talk. just to even things out. it is very strange that people just have no qualms to some degree about just, you know, telling you how to be and what to look like and where to live and where to go and what to eat and who to talk to. It's amazing. And it's very specific to that. You would never tell your, you never go to your accountant and go, yeah, he needs to highlight his hair. You know, like, you need to, I don't like your shoes. Like, who cares? Go away. It's just fascinating.
And speaking of Twitter, recently you had an update on your Twitter about what your mother is reading stories to you as a child?
Yeah, because it's Mother's Day here last weekend, and I, you know, I just kind of, instead of just going happy Mother's Day to everybody, I really wanted to kind of make the point of why I thought my mom was great. And when I was a kid, Mad Magazine would do these movie spoofs in them, but they would always write song parodies in them. But they were always, they'd have the lyrics written, and then it would say, sung to the tune of yada, 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 you know, You Light Up My Life or something. But they were always songs that were, I was too young to know. And so I would yell for my mom, and I would go, Mom, come in here. And then she'd have to sing me the song so I would know what the joke was.
Oh.
So my nighttime lullabies when I was a kid were songs out of Mad Magazine.
Fantastic. What a cool mom.
Yeah, she's spectacular. I love her very much. And she, you know, she was the one who, you know, when I... There are only two people in my whole family who, when I said I was moving to L.A. to be an actor, didn't bat an eye and said, go for it. And that was my mom and her mom, my grandmother, and who's my last remaining grandparent. I'm down to one, you know. And both of them were just overwhelmingly supportive and just said, whatever you want to do, because happiness is the most important thing.
Hal, could you tell us a little bit about Farm Sanctuary?
Oh, yeah. Farm Sanctuary is an organization in the States that rescues animals that were on their way to slaughter and by some trick of fate managed to escape. Let's say a slaughterhouse is shut down for some sort of reason and there are leftover animals that no one wants to care for. Farm Sanctuary takes them in, releases them onto a farm, basically, like an animal reserve, essentially, and takes care of them so that they live out their life, in peace and safety and happiness. And it's a sweet organization. The classic story is that there's most people don't know this, but there's actually a slaughterhouse in Brooklyn, New York, right over the river from New York. It's kind of amazing that, you know, less than a mile from the Empire State Building, there's a slaughterhouse. It's very strange. But they had a cow that escaped from the slaughterhouse, and she ran around the streets of Brooklyn for a day. They were trying to catch her, and Animal Services was out and all this stuff. And the people in Farm Sanctuary saw this on the news, immediately went down there and bought her from the slaughterhouse so that she would not be returned. And she lives on a farm in upstate New York. It's a really sweet story. They're good people, and they do it to promote vegan and vegetarian lifestyle and anti-cruelty concepts to people. I really support them. They're awesome. They're also on Twitter at Farm Sanctuary. They're really solid people. And I've been involved in, you know, the Humane Society in the United States and a couple other political causes as well for quite some time. I do radio on Air America over here, which is sort of the liberal talk. I campaigned for Obama in six swing states before he got elected, right up to the election. You know, I've got my fingers in a lot of those areas over here.
Are you still dating the vegan girlfriend?
I'm not, but we're still good friends, and she still lives in my home. But it's because of her that, you know, I have basically a vegan diet. I'm a pescatarian, so I still eat fish, you know, but she's very pivotal in getting me involved in a lot of these issues, and that won't change by any stretch. So
I was going to say, she must have been thrilled you were helping out with Farm Sanctuary.
Yeah, and still am. They named a goat after me. They saved a goat from a farm. And so there's a goat at Farm Sanctuary named Hal that if you go on their website, you can actually see him. They have a picture of him. He's adorable, as he should be, you know, since he bears my namesake.
Is he going to shave his goatee?
Yeah, no, he's not, actually. He gets to keep it. And it's one of the reasons why I believe I should be able to keep mine as well, since I have relatives in the goat family now.
You know you've made it when someone's named a goat after you. You don't need a street or a statue or anything, just a goat.
Yeah, Well, you know, I've had some pretty extreme, you know, when you've made it moments in my life so far. I have a lot of people don't know this, but it's funny that I haven't been to Australia yet, because I go to China a lot, and it's, you know, just a hop, skip, and a jump. I have a Chinese name, and from that I have a Chinese chop, which is, you know, your little like the little stamp that you use on letters that is in old ancient Chinese writing. And a woman had that tattooed on her neck.
Your Chinese name.
Name. Yeah.
And so
it's Huo Guanghao.
Say that again.
My first name is Huo Guanghao. My first name is Guanghao, and my last name is Huo, H-U-O. And it's funny, because when you if you tell you know, Mandarin speakers that's, you know, when they ask me my name, then I tell them my Chinese name, they always go, "Very handsome." Because it's in Chinese, that's like the equivalent of having a name like John Wayne or Harrison Ford. You know, I'm very proud of it.
That is awesome. Hal, we've got a game we like to play with our guests on the Hump Day Crew. It's called 101 Questions. Now, we're not going to ask you all of the 101 questions. We're going to let you choose the numbers, and we're going to ask you the according questions. So choose a number for us between 1 and 101.
Sure. Well, let's start with 69. I'm sure you get that one all the time.
69. Okay, Hal, if you were a car, what color would you be?
I would be suicide black, which is, I don't know, you know, or murder blacked out, I guess is the other way of phrasing it, depending on where you're from. Murder black is when it's like a matte dark black with no gleam coming off of it.
That's very 01 of you.
But I'd also have a flame job, so that'd be cool too, I guess.
Is that the kind of car that you drive at the moment?
No, you can't drive a murder black Prius. It's just sort of counterintuitive. I drive a hybrid, so it is gunmetal gray. That's as cool as they get, but not currently.
Pick a number between 1 and 101 for us.
What is the most humiliating moment of your life?
Wow. You mean so far? I once, I had a huge crush on this girl from high school who I was deeply, deeply in love with. And she broke up with her boyfriend and came out to California, asked me to help her drive her brother's van all the way across the country so we'd be alone for a week, basically. And I was sure that this was when she finally decided that I was the one and that we were going to be together and that she'd come to her senses and all this. And I, halfway through the trip, I expressed my undying love for her. And it was kind of a lukewarm reception. And then when we finally arrived in Michigan, where her brother's house was, her ex-boyfriend was waiting there for her, and they had gotten back together over the phone during the trip.
Aww.
And I had to spend 2 days at the house with her and her would-be fiancé after having basically told her that I loved her desperately. Yeah, so that's a rough one. I don't know if that qualifies as the most, but it's certainly in the top five.
Ouch! What a bitch! That was really harsh of her.
And is she kicking herself now? You betcha.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
Okay.
At that time, she had no idea I'd be on television. Anyway.
Yes, you got the last laugh. Pick one more number for us, Hal.
Let's see. Let's go. My grandmother is 96, so we'll go with 96.
At the movie theater, which armrest is yours?
Both.
Your house sparks, of course they are.
Yeah, exactly. First of all, my I'm not a small guy, but my arms aren't that, like, I'm not like one of these people who bleeds over into the seat next to them. So I've often shared an armrest pretty comfortably, even on a plane. So I'm, you know, but yeah, as far as I'm concerned, and you know why both of them are mine? Because I sit down front, dead center, and nobody else wants to sit there.
Why are you sitting at the front of a movie theater?
Because I like to be in it. That's how I became an actor in the first place. You know, I like to be completely engrossed in the environment of the movie. I don't want to see the theater around me. I don't want to hear people snacking. I don't want to even see the other seats or other heads in front of me. It's almost depressing when people are between me and the action, which, like I said, probably explains why I ended up in film and television. So,
well, Hal, thank you very much for joining us. It's been a pleasure chatting to you.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure, too. You guys are awesome. And hopefully, you know, when I make my way down there, we'll visit.
Absolutely. You have to look us up, and we'll have you in the studio, and we'll have lots of fun.
That would be great. Perfect. Awesome. Which city are you guys in?
We're in Melbourne.
Oh, great. Okay, yeah.
So if you come down for the Comedy Festival.
That's where Catherine's from, my personal organizer.
Well, you have to say hello to Catherine for us.
Yeah, and I have a good friend from Perth, so, you know, I've got a lot of friends.
There's only two people in Perth.
Oh, yeah, lots of good people in Perth, and a couple of weird ones. A couple of fucking weird ones. All right. Cool, so it was lovely talking to you. I'll see you guys someday soon.
Absolutely. Take it easy, Hal.
Okay, bye-bye.
Ciao.
See you, bye.
Hey, this is Ads from the Hump Day Crew. Thank you so much for listening to another one of our podcasts, and thank you for supporting the Hump Day Crew and Joy 94.9.
This podcast was produced by Joy Media. You can support Joy's diverse sound and diverse community this June by donating to Joy Radiothon 2024. Go to joy.org.au/radiothon. And remember, we all flourish with joy.